For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, one of the issues when we're reading Proverbs is that we are in a different covenant today than they were back then. In the Bible, there's the Old Covenant, which was under Moses, and then the New Covenant that was brought by Jesus. So if you turn to passages like in Deuteronomy 27 through 30, you see the blessings and the cursings in the Mosaic covenant they had, that covenant with Moses brought from God and the people. And so for four chapters it goes on, if you violate the covenant, these are the curses, these are the punishments that will come down on you. But if you keep the covenant, these are the blessings that will come down on you. All of this section of Scripture does not apply to us. And it would be a hermeneutical mistake to think that God deals with us that way. An example, a case in point, one of the cursings and blessings is that if you violate this covenant, you will be exiled from your land, scattered all over the world. And then if you turn back, I'll regather you from all over the world back into your land. So that promise and warning and promise made there obviously doesn't apply to us. We have nothing to do with the land of Israel. That is for the nation of Israel specifically. And that the whole list is along those lines. I'll make your crops grow, or I won't. Or I'll let your enemies come in and they'll overtake you militarily. I won't protect you. So quite a few of the blessings mentioned there have to do with wealth. That if you follow this covenant, I'll bless you financially and make you, you know, like have plenty of money and food and stuff. So we see this reflected in the book of Proverbs, 8 verse 18. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness. This is a wisdom, Dame Wisdom speaking, Lady Wisdom personified here. And of course it goes on to say, my fruit is better than gold, even pure gold, and my yield better than the choice of silver. So yet there is the promise of wealth here, but also something more important than wealth when we get to wisdom. 13:22, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the sinner's wealth is laid up for the righteous. Well, that's probably a general observation of, you know, the way things usually work. People that are serious about following God aren't out wasting their money and throwing it away. So there's usually, when they die, there's some money left over for their children and even their children's children. Proverbs 3:16, long life is in her wisdom's right hand. In her left hand are riches and honor. 10:22, the blessings of the Lord make a person rich, and he adds no sorrow with it. 14:24, wealth is a crown for the wise, and the effort of fools yields only foolishness. 24:3, a house is built by wisdom and becomes strong through good sense. Through knowledge, its rooms are filled with all sorts of precious riches and valuables. Okay, if you've read your New Testament, you've noticed that none of these kind of statements are made in the New Testament. This whole teaching is alien to the New Covenant. And in fact, all of the heroes of the New Testament are all poor, like Jesus. He said, even foxes have a place to lay their head. The Son of Man have holes they can live in, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Paul says we're poorly clothed, roughly treated, often hungry. You know, Peter, John, all of the great men of and women of faith. There were a few that were like Barnabas had land, but when he shows up, he's selling the land and giving the money to the poor. So you know, this just clearly represents a different covenant. And so one of the things we need to do in reading Proverbs and correctly discerning it is to try to determine what should be applied, you know, what applies to us and what should be discounted as being of the Old Covenant. Under the Old Covenant, it's focused mainly on material blessings. If you read like the blessings and cursings in that section of Deuteronomy, they're all material. They all have to do with crops, you know, storms, diseases, armies, things like that. It's in this life, material blessings or cursing. The new covenant focuses on spiritual and relational blessings. We're always directed toward our life with God. And in addition, the benefits of a life well lived, you know, in the body of Christ and the community of God. The only thing it says about our material well-being in the New Testament, it promises that our basic needs will be met. When Jesus talked about, you know, don't be anxious about what you're going to eat or wear, for your heavenly Father knows all these things and he will take care of you on that. So give us our this day our daily bread. That's all we need. We get our bread, and Paul says if we have food and covering, we should be satisfied with that. The Old Testament blessings are temporal blessings. They're temporary. You're blessed during this life. The focus is not as much on the next life. It does come up. We saw that earlier in Proverbs. I mean, they believed in it, but it was kind of vague, that part, whereas the main focus was on this life. In the New Covenant, the focus is more on the eternal. It's more on the relational. In the Old Covenant, all of this is tied to the idea that they're a theocratic nation, that you have this nation state, Israel, run, you know, a government of priests and kings, and that's the setting for the teaching. In the New Testament, none of that is true. There is no theocracy anymore. It's neither implied or stated, assumed. Instead, the opposite is stated, which is whatever land you're in, submit to the governing authority in that land. And so there is no effort to create a Christian state at all. So just considering those differences right there, anything that's tied to one of those things on the left should probably be questioned or rejected. On the other hand, the Proverbs in the Old Testament contain moral principles, general wise outcomes, just observation that wise people, you know, tend to live this way, foolish ones that way, foolish outcomes. The observation based on the nature of God, that hasn't changed. Based on the created order, that hasn't changed either. So all of those would also be found in the New Covenant. So there is substantial overlap, probably way more overlap than there is difference. And the principle I would suggest is that we're looking for statements that are logically bounded by these Old Covenant principles, something referring to your fields will this and that, or, you know, your enemies will be defeated in battle, something like that that's tied to the theocratic nation or to those temporal spatial blessings promised in the Old Covenant. Those are not going to apply. And I can't believe how many commentators fail to see this and actually in their reading still imply that this is true. But the fact of them, it's not true. A lot of intense followers of Christ are extremely poor. They're not rich. And yet they are wise people. That's not what Jesus has promised us in our covenant. Anything else, though, that's not tied to the Old Covenant like that, it does apply. And so when we read this passage, a house is built by wisdom, I would say on the second part, through knowledge its rooms are filled with all sorts of precious riches and valuables. You know, in the New Covenant, we're advised if we have riches and valuables, we should only keep the part we need and use the other part to further the kingdom of God in this world and to minister to the poor. And so filling your rooms with riches and valuables would be something that we would not consider to be a very good idea at all. Let's go through about five different areas of teaching. The material on this is Proverbs is immense. So we're going to do a fair amount of reading, and I'm still only getting probably half of the passages involved. Debt. Yeah. What does Proverbs say about debt? The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave of the lender. He's not saying that this is the way it should be. He's just observing that's the way it is. And when you come into debt, it's a type of bondage where now someone has something on you. It was especially bad in the ancient world where they had debtors, all kinds of debtors' prison. Like you could seize your property, everything you owned. There was no bankruptcy laws, the kind of things that we have today that kind of keep you from losing everything. None of that was there. You could be sold as a slave if you couldn't pay your debt. It's that bad. So, getting into debt, very bad idea in ancient times. It's still a bad idea. It's not wise. We should try to avoid debt. Also, guaranteeing other people's debt. He who is a guarantor for a stranger will surely suffer for it, but he who hates being a guarantor is secure. A man lacking in sense pledges and becomes a guarantor in the presence of his neighbor. So here's somebody wants to borrow money, and so you come and guarantee their repayment in the presence of witnesses. Now you're on the hook. That's just the same as you having that debt yourself. Do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become guarantors for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take your bed from underneath? That's literally can take your house. You're out on the street because you guaranteed someone else's loan. So, why should the wise not become guarantors of loans for other people? In the first place, because they understand human nature. You know, if you're not an idiot, a naive, a simpleton, then you know that, first of all, people make mistakes all the time. To err is human. You know that. You know that people are not necessarily honest, and that they may give you a story for why they need this money and why they can easily pay it back soon, and they may not be telling the truth. And therefore, the chances are significant. Here's a person who needed to borrow money in the first place. Why are they borrowing? Why don't they just take it from what they're earning? See, there's already a problem when somebody needs to borrow money. And you're buying into that problem. People that are wise put boundaries on their friendships. People come by, someone comes by, dude, you're my buddy. How about co-signing for this loan for me? Sign your own loan. If we just feel like we have to, you know, like we just have to do anything within our power for anybody, regardless of, you know, whether that's something that is in their true interests, how do we know we're not just encouraging irresponsibility? We need boundaries. We need the ability to not be dragged into everyone else's problems to that extent. Wise people refuse to take foolish risks. And the risks here would be huge, potentially. If you want to help somebody, if somebody is run short of money, it's better to give them the money than to guarantee a loan for them. If debt is bad for me to get into debt, then it's bad for them to get into debt. So why would I want to guarantee a loan? If I want to help them, give them money. This way, you'll find that, we were taught this as young believers, and I always went by it, like guys in the house would be, man, dude, loan me a couple $100 for rent. I'd be like, no, I'm not loaning. I don't loan money to friends, because there's so many examples where people borrowed money, couldn't repay it, and it's caused all kinds of relational problems. It's not wise. Don't loan. If somebody needs help, then they should be humble enough to come and ask for it and receive a gift. Perhaps. Here's another issue. Trusting in riches. Powerfully taught against in the book of Proverbs. 13:7. There's one who makes himself rich yet has nothing, and one who makes himself poor yet has great riches. It's kind of like a little riddle, isn't it? What do you think it means? I'll tell you what I think it means. The person that makes himself rich but has nothing is the materialist. That's the person who's just living for the dollar. He's collected all these dollars. He's really extremely poor, poverty-stricken spiritually. And then the person who has made himself poor, perhaps because he's given a lot of his money away, but has great riches because of all the love in his life and because of all the good that he's done and because of his relationship with God, which he values as more important than the materialistic pursuits, and that's why he's really a rich person. What are true riches? This is the question. True riches. Money? Or is it more on the spiritual and relational side of life? 11:28, he who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like foliage. 11:4, wealth is worthless in the day of judgment, but righteousness delivers from death. Boy, that's true. What good is all a bunch of money going to do you on the day that we come, on the judgment day, when we come before God? Nothing. You won't even have the money anymore. You lost that the moment that you passed out of this life. So righteousness, yeah, being on God's side, that will deliver from death. So they understood that perfectly well. When a wicked man dies, his hope perishes. All he expected to come from his power comes to nothing. Yeah, obviously. You knew that was going to come. This must be the Kasil. Couldn't see what the future, what obviously was going to happen not very long from now. Put all of his trust in temporal wealth and money and the power that comes with that. And all of a sudden, boom, it's all gone. It perishes with him. No, this is a great one here. 30 verse 7 through 9. Two things I ask of you, O Lord. Do not refuse me before I die. First, keep falsehood and lies far from me. Second, give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? It's like you've forgotten who he is. Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. So this is really right in line with Paul's teaching, right? About having all what you need for daily, whatever. You should be content with that. To be poor is perilous. It's dangerous to be poor. It can cause a lot of problems in your life. You should try to avoid that. You should be wise enough to be looking ahead and have a plan for how you plan to avoid poverty in your life and all the cascading problems that come with that for you, your spouse, your children, and everyone else. On the other hand, riches are also dangerous, perilous, like he says. And so we'll talk more about that later. Let's talk about the poor a little bit. A lot taught about the poor. We'll just have to take a few examples. First, in 30 verse 22, do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their case and will take the life of those who rob him. You know, most of the wealth in the ancient world came from oppressing the poor. A lot of it still does. We are in a little bit different situation in our country where, you know, with kind of open commerce and just the fabulous quantity of wealth that we have, like most people are basically wealthy. We don't have that many poor people. That's not the way it was in the ancient world. And the rich were usually the oppressors. That they were the gentry. They were the taxers. And there's harsh warning here. You better not. God's going to get you. He who oppresses the poor to make more for himself, or who gives to the rich, will only come to poverty. Oppressing the poor so he can make more for himself. Giving to the rich, probably bribes, or flattering gifts that you're trying to get in. Well, you know, obviously they don't need it, whatever you're giving them. They're rich, right? So there's probably some self-serving reason why you're giving gifts to rich people to make an impression. And so you come to poverty. 19:17, if you help the poor, you are lending to the Lord. He will repay you. God says, you give money and you give help to the poor, graciousness to the poor. You can consider that a loan to me. It's like you're loaning me money. And God pays his debts. I'll pay that back and with interest. 14:31, he who oppresses the poor taunts his maker. But he who is gracious to the needy honors him. Taunting God. What are you going to do about it? You know? The raised fist to God, not a good idea. Not a good idea at all. How about this one? The rich and the poor have a common bond. The Lord is the maker of them all. That's a good one there to think about. You ever thought about this question? What is the basis for equality among humans? You know, we're kind of used to this form of thinking in the West and in America in particular. We've got a constitution that says all men are created equal. And I guess they meant women when they said that too, but it wasn't really that clear. You know, I mean, even when that was written, they were slaves. Still, they weren't equal. Women really weren't equal. They weren't allowed to vote. And when you think about it, people really, what do we mean when we say all people are equal? They're not equal in size. You have bigger people, you have littler people. They're not equal in ethnicity. Some are from one race, some are from another. That's not equal. They're not equal in gender. Some are female, some are male. Those are different. They're not equal in social class or wealth. There's the rich, there's the poor. In what sense are they equal then? They're not equal. And yet, there's this nagging sense that we have, that we all have, that they are equal. And in truth, they are. Because of this right here, the Lord is the maker of them all. There's your reason. If you're from a materialistic worldview, you cannot say why people are equal and why the powerful shouldn't oppress the weak. But from our theistic worldview, we understand that not only is the Lord the maker of them all, but that humans were created in his image. Male and female, he created them in his image. And so we have a powerful argument here. You got to think about this the next time you're talking to one of your naturalistic friends. Ask them what they see as the basis for equality among people. It's a real good question. Because it's not a material equality. It's a spiritual and personal equality. To the materialist, though, your body is all you are. So how can we be viewed as equal? Awesome. Proverbs 23, do not move the ancient boundary or go into the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is strong and he will plead their case against you. To move the boundary stone is how you're stealing land. That's how they kept track of where your field ends and where mine begins. And so you move it over a few feet and the guy's coming in saying, wait a minute, you moved that. No, it's where it's always been. And, you know, he's talking about the fatherless, those with the weak, the orphans. And widows and orphans were weak in the ancient culture because there was no social network, no social security, very hard to get work. They were usually poor. They didn't have a man there to go out with his, you know, sword and defend them. And so people could take advantage of them. You better not. This is such interesting type of teaching found here in Proverbs as well as all throughout the covenant that goes all the way back to the time of Moses. The protection of the poor. Absent from other ancient legal codes, of which we have quite a few examples, Egyptian, Babylonian, Akkadian, Sumerian, they all have legal codes. None of them have this kind of material end that of taking care of the poor and the weak. It's uniquely biblical. I've been reading the excellent book by G. Ernest Wright, The Old Testament Against Its Environment, with a friend of mine again. And oh my God, every time I read it, I'm just so happy to read that book. You should read that book if you haven't read it. It's in the ebooks. G. E. Wright, OTAE, Old Testament Against Its Environment. He goes through and just shows how radically different Israel's law was than anything else in the ancient world. It's fascinating. And he's not even a believer. So, do not oppress the poor. And of course, this is another stress in the New Testament as well. Read James 5 sometime about the evil rich. Come now, ye rich, weep and howl for the judgment coming upon you, and so forth. And he talks about you have withheld the workman's wages. You have murdered him who was not opposing you. Okay, let's move to the question of attitudes toward money. 23 verse 4, do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. Pretty good advice. Paul teaches the same thing. People who want to get rich plunge themselves into ruin and despair. and pierced themselves with many pains, he says. 14:20, the poor are despised even by their neighbor, while the rich have many, quote, friends. Yeah, the quotes belong on there. Obviously, if they're coming around because the person has money, they're not really friends in any deep sense, in any real sense. They're probably just trying to get a piece of the action, right? So, that's bullcrap. And the poor, despised by their neighbor. Yeah, nobody's lining up to say, oh, can I hang around with you? Oh, I'd love to have you for dinner. It's a sin to belittle, but he goes on in the next verse. It's a sin to belittle one's neighbor. Blessed are those who help the poor. So, not despising the poor, but helping them, not belittling them. The poor man utters supplication, but the rich man answers roughly. Get a job. Now, whatever. That attitude of, you know, what's their problem? Marie Antoinette, you know. So, if they don't have bread, tell them to eat cake. You know, so what's wrong with it? Complete inability to understand the plight of the poor. He who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like the green leaf. Better to be poor and honest than to be dishonest and rich. Rich people may think they're wise, but a poor person with discernment can see right through. And so, in these examples and many more besides, now I guess I have a few more, let's see. The name of the Lord is a strong fortress. The godly run to him and are safe. The rich think their wealth is a strong defense. They imagine it to be a high wall of safety. Haughtiness goes before destruction, and humility precedes honor. See, that's all one thought. That's 18, 10, 11, 12. Yeah, that's where he's talking about the main perils, the dangers of riches. In first place, pride. Also, self-sufficiency and false security. All the things, why do people gather up, you know, wealth and possessions? One of the biggest things is pride. And to show, you know, it's like keeping scores, to show who's winning. I am. I'm better. Look at, you don't have this like I do. And so there's a comparison of people between one another. There's that self-sufficiency so that I don't have to trust in God for my security. I'm building up layers of security, and it's false security too. The world, yeah. Let's just remember a few things about this for our lives today. In the first place, the question is not how much money you make, but rather how much you keep. So there's certainly nothing wrong with making lots of money. But the ethical question comes in when I'm going to keep it all for me. And I'm not a generous person. I'm not a giver. I'm a taker. Remember that in our world, career and pride in our career is number one, even above money. It's having that title. It's being the vice president of, you know, X, Y, and Z corporation for development or whatever. Doctor so-and-so. Expert this, you know, cool sounding job that. And that's people want that so they can have that as their identity. They're really trying to establish, I'm an important person, I matter because of my career. And that is the belief system of our culture that we're in. Of course, we know that riches are no more a fortress today than they ever were. Nothing has changed. How the secular world today, we turn on our TV and they believe in something called financial security. You know, as Christians, we don't even believe there's such a thing as financial security. How could finances ever give you any security? Look at 13:8. The rich can pay a ransom for their lives, but the poor won't even get threatened. That's a very interesting. That's a very interesting thought. You know, what does more riches bring you? More security? No, usually just more anxiety, more that you can lose. You're a deep pocket now, so everybody wants, you know, is after your money and the danger of being sued. You got to get multiple layers of insurance, and so on and so forth. Diversify, get your stuff offshore, you know. And the anxieties of the rich, what Jesus called the worries and cares of the world. choke out the spiritual fruit. There is an elegance, a protection in just being poor. Nobody wants, everyone can see you don't have anything worth taking. I remember I used to drive this pretty crappy looking car and stuff. And it had an old stereo deck that was obviously out of date. Worked great though. So I could just leave it anywhere on campus with the windows down, which is kind of nice in the summer, And people would be, "What, you're not locking up?" And I'd be like, "There's nothing here to have. It's not a Target. They're going to go walk right past this with the down windows and go break your windows to get into your nice car," which happened in many, many. I have seven friends robbed out of their cars all the time. Never mind, for some reason, they didn't want it. There it is, right there. Well, of course, we know that what we believe in is not financial security. We don't think there's such a thing. We believe in something called eternal security. That's where you come to God, you tell Him I'm ready to accept the work that Jesus did for me, the price He paid to get me forgiven. I'm ready to start a relationship with you. I'm ready to invite you into my life. It's called receiving Christ. In John 1, it says, "To as many as received Him, He gave the right to become children of God." So it's necessary to not just to academically or mentally assent that, yeah, Jesus' death had something to do with sin. It's necessary to receive that gift in the sense that you tell God, "I want that to apply to me. And I want to start my relationship with you, not just attending a church, but actually knowing you like I would another person." And so when we do that, then as Jesus puts in Hebrews 13, "I will never leave you. I will never forsake you." And we have this awesome guarantee for eternity. As He puts it in John 5, "If anyone believes in me, he's passed out of death into life." And eternal life. Yeah, there's security. Let's talk about how come the poor are poor. There's a lot of different reasons. And some of them have to do with problems that poor people themselves have. This is why to help the poor, often we have to go, we need to go beyond simple handouts. That doesn't help. The more we hand out, the more of it gets wasted. And what we need is to get in relationally with poor people and help them to learn the things they need to know so that they can change their way of life and be relieved permanently from poverty. Proverbs 24:27, "Prepare your work outside and make it ready for yourself in the field. Afterwards, then, build your house." See what he's saying? You want a house. You want a nice place. So you're going to, they built their own houses, The family would build a house. He says, first, plant the field. Get the food growing. Then you can plan a house. Order of operations. It's a problem among poor people. Foolishness. Why are you buying a rich car when, you can't even put food on the table? Delayed gratification. That's what we're talking about. It's delayed gratification. You need to go to school first. Then you can have money. Why are you wearing gold and carrying on like you're rich when, in fact, you're very poor? First, undergo the frustration, tolerate the frustration necessary to get to a point where you can become a true earner. Those who love pleasure become poor. Those who love wine and luxury will never be rich. Huge problem in poor communities. In our country and other countries as well. Alcoholism, drug addiction, sexual promiscuity. The family can't be formed. Dad, I know in many countries with relief organizations we've worked with, where they set up micro-lending, they will only lend to women in those cultures. And it's because the men are all out drunk and chasing prostitutes all the time. If they lend money to them, they'll just take it out and spend it on something and go, they won't loan to them. And so the women, it falls on the women to try to put together a family and to feed the children. It's pitiful. All too common. Work brings profit, but mere talk leads to poverty. Well, we saw this, of course, when we studied the sluggard. A lot of people have all these grandiose plans. They're always talking about, oh man, I'm going to start a business or this and that, or I'm waiting on this job that's going to come in, and it's all talk, 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 instead of work, work, work. Wealth obtained by fraud dwindles, but the one who gathers by labor increases it. Fraud, cheating, lying, con work, gambling, so typical. If you've ever done work, if you've ever spent time in super poor cultures, that's what they do. It'd be very hard to get a business going there because of the cheating, the fraud, the graft, the corruption is so intense. It just makes it hard to even succeed at anything. A man with an evil eye hastens after riches and does not consider that poverty will come upon him. The get-rich-quick scheme. Poor people are notoriously vulnerable to this thinking. That's why people that sell these, that market these get-rich-quick schemes, which are really con deals where they get money out of people and cheat them, ply poor neighborhoods because they know those are the ones that will sucker for this. So really lusting for the quick buck is one of the moral and spiritual problems that leads to poverty. Dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. And you know, several other, this comes up over and over. Of course, this was back when they didn't have digital scales or anything, so you had weights, and you'd keep one set here when you were weighing out their money, and in a different set when you were weighing out the merchandise that you're giving to them. It's just a way to cheat people. Cheating, thieving. So in thinking it through poverty, we have to realize there are other reasons for poverty, including institutional, cultural biases against the poor, which we'll speak of in a moment. And I wish we could spend more time on tonight. Let's take up this question. What is money supposed to be for, according to the Bible? First of all, meeting basic needs. I need money to put food on a table, to put clothes on our back, to have a place to live. Basic needs. Secondly, giving. Oh, yeah. I guess the secular world missed this part. But this is one of the main points in earning an income, according to the Old and New Testament, both. Paul says, let him who steals steal no longer, but let him work doing that which is useful with his hands, that he may have something to give to him in need. That he may have something to give. Now, that's why you should get a career, so you can become a giver instead of a taker. This is something, now you would have to understand the importance of Jesus' teaching that he who loses his life for my sake gains it. That living your life for a self-serving theory ends up self-corrupting. Think about this too. Having wealth is not a sin according to the Bible. However, when you juxtapose our wealth to the poverty in the world today, I think it does bring up some very powerful and maybe painful questions for those of us in the rich countries to consider. Think about the lives we lead. You know, everything's kind of shiny, enjoying our lives. We're out, we like to go to the gym. Of course, we got to go there to keep the fat off. That's the biggest problem we have, is just eating so much. We're getting fat, so we got to work out and spend hundreds of dollars on that. You know, why does this woman, why can't she even protect her little baby from starvation? And you know, how do those look next to each other? We live these lives, you know, where everything's very, you know, shiny, happy. We, you know, social, romantic, having a great time, and, you know, drinking some cocktails. They live in a world of filth and disease, death stalking at all times, starvation never far away. We like to get out and party, act sexy, you know, groove, with our friends. Partying, that'd be the last thing they ever have on their mind. They're trying to just survive another day. We feel like there's nothing wrong with being pampered, you know, we'll spend hundreds, thousands just basically on frivolous, exotic, self-serving, you know, wealth. And then we look over, why should this woman have to sleep on the sidewalk in Calcutta? Why is she near death? If you're a sensitive, spiritual person, a Christian, do you see, does that jar your conscience in any way, that contrast? I think it does. I think it's troubling. Of course, the ideal is not for the lady on the floater to become like this woman in Calcutta. That's not the ideal here. But is there nothing that she can do to help? Is this really a good idea, you know, to drop a few thousand on something like that? And of course, you know, for anyone with any sense, anyone who's not a fool would realize that lying on that air mattress out there is going to become pretty boring pretty soon. It's not even like it's really that great. Boy, the poor must look into our wealthy, self-indulgent lifestyles and baffled. What is this? How can people live like that? And so I think that this is part of what we're being confronted with, you know, in the Proverbs and elsewhere in Scripture, is that the enjoyment of wealth is contingent on the fact that the poor have their needs met. Listen to the Proverbs 11:25. A generous man will prosper, but he who refreshes others will himself be refreshed. He who shuts his ear to the cry of the poor will also be himself cry out and not be answered. He who gives to the poor will never want, but he who shuts his eyes will have many curses. Shutting our eyes, closing our ears, I don't see anything, no problem. It's the attitude the rich don't want to look. They don't want to look at that. So we'll build gated communities, you know, with high walls and security gates around them to keep the poor out. And, you know, it's an attitude. It says here, if we shut our eyes to the poor, we'll have many curses. Doesn't sound too good. You know, I'm not sure who's doing the cursing here, but I get the feeling it might be God. That's not good. 29:7, the righteous is concerned for the rights of the poor. The wicked does not understand such concern. Oh God, why do we have to keep talking about this? We're always bringing this up again. Says the wicked man. He doesn't understand why people are so worked up about the poor. It really just sails right over. He who despises his neighbor sins, but happy is he who's gracious to the poor. One of the greatest laws, the most fascinating laws in the Old Covenant, this is not with us anymore, but it's instructive, I think, to kind of show the mentality that God has. It's called the Jubilee Year. In this, a jubilee happened every 7 times 7 years, so 49 years. The next year would be called a jubilee year. Here's some of the legislation on it. This is from the book of Leviticus. It says, the land must never be sold on a permanent basis, for the land belongs to me. God's speaking here. It's my land. When you sell a piece of property, that other person you sold, you didn't own it, and the guy you sold it to, he didn't own it either. I own that property. Because the Bible teaches in Psalm 24:1, the world is the Lord's and everyone in it. He owns this whole place. So, he says, you're only foreigners and tenant farmers working for me. You're like a tenant farmer. You've rented a farm. With every purchase of land, you must grant the seller the right to buy it back. Well, that's okay. So if someone runs into financial problems, they have to sell their plot. That could endanger their lives. And this is how the rich gain control over more and more and more. And then the poor, you know, can't get it back. And so they just have nowhere to turn. And he says, no, they are allowed to buy that back anytime they show up with the money. If one of your fellow Israelites falls into poverty and is forced to sell some family land, then a close relative should buy it back for him. That's so the family could stick together. He says, if there is no close relative to buy the land, but the person who sold it gets enough money to buy it back, then he has the right to redeem it from the one who bought it. The price of the land will be discounted according to the number of years until the next year of Jubilee. In this way, the original owner can return to the land. Discounted by the number of years till the next Jubilee. So if it's 25 years till the next year of Jubilee, that means you get to keep that land for 25 years. At the end of the Jubilee, everything gets given back free of charge to the one that sold it. So obviously, if it's only 5 years to the Jubilee, the property ain't worth that much because I only get to work it 5 years and I'm going to give it back. Yeah. What if the original owner cannot afford to buy back the land? It will remain with the new owner until the next year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee year, the land must be returned to the original owner so they can return to their family land. This is how then in the Jubilee legislation, which was not popular in Israel, you can imagine why. This is how God kept the rich from monopolizing and marginalizing the poor, is that everything went back to its original owner with certain key exceptions, like houses built, bought in the city didn't go back because, you know, you're living in a house and you bought it, you don't have to return that. But land had to go back. How about this one? Abundant food is in the fallow ground of the poor, but it is swept away by injustice. That's true in one country after another around the world still today. The whole country is poor, and yet it's a wealthy country, has plenty of natural resources. They could easily feed themselves, but it is swept away by injustice. It's almost impossible to make a living there because of the corruption and injustice. A ruler who oppresses the poor is like a driving rain that leaves no crops. Well, people like to say, but we're in the most generous country in the world, you know, we're really givers, really helping everyone. Actually, you know, that's far from true. We're like 24th. We're way down the list of developed countries in per capita giving to other countries. And also, the money that Americans do give is usually not for the poor. For example, in this study put out by the University of Indiana, the Center on Philanthropy, they showed that of people making $200,000 or more, most of their giving by far goes to things such as, you know, researching health things and arts. The arts, that's a big draw. The poor is just a tiny little percentage. All American giving, the same output showed, $253 billion goes to, is totally given to charitable causes, but only $19 billion of that is going to basic needs of the poor. You'll see, I saw, I think it was the day before yesterday, I saw this real tearjerker ad about the poor children in some country and how you could sponsor one and they could get food and shots. And then, you know, after the next ad, it was an ad for cats that have no owner and how by you could sponsor the cat. And people that study this, you know that the cats are getting more money than the children are. That is what Americans like to give to, stuff like that. Helping the cat get the surgery it needs. We believe in giving to the poor, and we're engaged in a host of noble projects. I don't have current numbers on it because this goes back to 2008, so it's 3 years old. We give over $2 million a year, $2.2 million a year is our fellowship to all having to do with work with the poor, and it's good work too. Really building into the lives of people, not just handouts. We don't get into that too much, unless we use it maybe temporarily to make contacts with people, but educational work, development work, building into the lives, and of course, it's taken in the name of Jesus and the gospel as well. So you're all going to get a chance to join in with us. If you haven't done so, hang around, because later this month we're going to come out and explain all these things that we're doing, and you can get a chance to join in with us and become somebody that's lending to the Lord. That's got to be a good investment there when you lend money to God. And so we should all remember what money is for, why God has given it to us. It's money is not dirty. It's not shameful. It's highly useful, really good. It does meet basic needs. And so we need it for that reason. And also, we can become powerful givers. And the thrill of becoming a giver and somebody that's building others up becomes pretty sweet. And I urge you to move into that. And there's a quick survey of teaching on finance.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.